Welcome to the Bloody Broads Pod. We're your Bloody Broads. I'm Bhavna Sharma.
And I'm Jamie Howard. This week, we are covering Halloween H2O with Blaine of Ladies and Ligaments. Blaine, would you like to introduce yourself?
Oh, yes, I would. Hi, I'm Blaine Waterloo. I am the host of the podcast Ladies and Ligaments. It's all about bringing MBs and queers together to talk about the heteronormative stereotypes and the same kind of themes that made us in the queer community. So it's a lot of fun.
And we're big fans over here yes. at Bloody Broads. So if you would like, how are things with Ladies and Ligaments? Kind of fill us in on what you got going on right now.
So right now I'm between seasons. I just wrapped up season one, which was so much fun and went by in a flash. So now I'm taking a few months to gather stories and ideas and reach out to people about, you know, fun, horny topics to discuss, as well as things going kind of aligning with the turmoil that America and the LGBTQIA plus community is experiencing. So yeah, we're lining things up. We're riding through the hellscape and we're coming back on September 5th.
We look forward
to
it.
Great
time to be alive. This is fine.jpg. Or PNG, whatever floats your digital image boat. Blaine, what horror have you been watching lately? I mean, aside from real life.
Thank you for adding that. This weekend, I was watching a lot of comfort movies. Well, actually, I should say I was indulging in May Day themed movies. Like, it was halfway to Halloween and we've got Beltane. So I dipped into some Midsummer, as well as Wicker Man, the 2006 version yes. with Nick Cage, yes. not the bees. and then today is the anniversary of The Craft. So I was watching that again because you have to.
Right. Follow-up question, how'd it get burned? Sorry, I quote The Wicker Man on like a daily basis in my real life, so it's just become a part of who I am.
I was going to say, Bob and I quote How to Get Burned like a million times per week.
The rapid succession of how to get burned, how to get burned. Like, I know. Love it. I want it to be my ringtone.
Hey, we're big. Oh.
I want that entire, there's a compilation on YouTube, which needs to be updated, of Nicolas Cage freaking out. And it's something from like the beginning of his career to about, I'd say, Ghost Rider, I want to say. It hasn't been updated since after that. But like, oh my God, I just want that to be, one, my ringtone, two, the intro to my funeral. And three, I don't know why this is third, the intro to my wedding.
So in watching that, I usually try to like avoid Nick Cage movies because it's like I need to be in the mood for it. But so in watching that, I completely remembered the appeal of Nick Cage, which is that he is both the best and worst part of the movie.
Correct.
So much fun.
Absolutely right.
Yes. I'll do it all day.
We're big Nick Cage fans here.
You're not watching a Nick Cage movie for the art. You're watching it for the art of Nick Cage.
I was going to say, speak for yourself.
Hey, I love Nick Cage. Like, I absolutely, unironically, I love the man. Oh, wow. Like, I love his films and stuff. Like, I know what they are. I know exactly what they are. A rootin' tootin' fun time. That's it. That's all I want.
Honest fan.
Dude, like Yosemite Sam.
Pew pew.
Pew pew pew. I just did guns for those of you who are only listening.
Yes. See, well, I told you I would take us wildly off track.
It's okay. I know. I wish we were recording what we were talking about just before this, but that might have to be a Patreon exclusive.
Yes.
Well, Blaine, here at Bloody Broads, we always allow our guests to come first. So how about you kick us off with your initial thought?
Okay, so my initial thoughts, and am I getting into my discussion notes? Is that allowed? Or am I just like saying
whatever you want?
Fantastic. Okay.
Well, overall,
it was fantastic. And I love this movie so much. It makes me very happy. It's nostalgic. It's got the 90s vibe, sound, actors. It's top to tail. Just a great time. But first, I wanted to ask you both, how do you feel about this Michael Myers mask?
Good question.
We all just put our hands over our mouths.
It was kind of Hot Topic-y for me.
No, yeah. You know what it was? It was Michael Myers after a fresh 10 units of Botox, and I respect that.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, so you mean like William Shatner in 1998?
Hey. Oh.
I know a lot of people shit on this version of Michael, and I love the majority of the Halloween franchise. I'm not going to go so far as to say all of it. Mm-hmm. But it's so funny you ask about this mask, because this is like, for Scream fans, this is like the version of the mask they use in the TV show. Like, we don't talk about it. We're just like, it is what it is. It's not canon. I will say, it does work for me in like a really weird way. And I think it's because in 1998, we were getting to that like peak glossy vibe where like Y2K fashion was starting to creep in, but it wasn't really mainstream yet. And I don't know, like this very superficial thing was coming in. Like more people were aware of Photoshop, you know, more people, not that we could use it on a daily basis like we can now, but the, you know, publications were using it. I don't know. It's just, to me, it's very zeitgeisty.
Yeah, it's almost like at the time when, you know, we had those blow up plastic chairs and stuff like that. It fits that vibe. Yes. Where everything's just a little off and a little fake. And that's exactly what you want, because you want the jellies. You want the, you know, sticker earrings. It fits perfectly.
It does. And to kind of tie into like our last episode on Urban Legend, like it's the same year. Both movies came out the same year. So aesthetically, very similar. But what kind of struck me with the fashion on this one, since we're on that topic, was Jamie Lee Curtis's like Dean clothing. Like,
yeah,
I was like, girl, none of that suits you. Like, even at your age at that point, like, yeah, you're supposed to be in your 30s or whatever, your mid to late 30s at that point. But it's like, girl, nuh-uh. None of that suits you.
And that's the thing. Like, she's gorgeous in this movie. Like, she is peak Jamie in this movie. Like, absolutely just perfect in every way. But that clothing is not working for her. She's trying to do
O'Hara?
Who am I talking about? Catherine O'Hara. Catherine O'Hara from Home Alone. Like, she's trying to do, like, chunky knit, like, typical mom thing. And maybe that's part of it. Like, maybe it's supposed to be, like, who is this person pretending to be a dean? And it's just, yeah. I don't know, maybe it's part of it.
Laurie Strode, that's who.
Yeah. As someone who loves Community, when you said dean, all I could think of was, like, Bob and I have a running joke of, like, all the times that he comes in, like, singing, Dean, 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 Dean. I thought you were going to say Catherine. He's so cute. At first, yes. I thought you were going to say Catherine O'Hara in Schitt's Creek, and I was like, oh, but I see it. But it
it's like a toned-down Catherine O'Hara in Schitt's Creek.
Right, prototype, because this came out, 15, 16 years before the first episode of Schitt's Creek?
Something like that.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is that this movie is basically all about confronting who you really are. And I think this pairs perfectly with what Blaine talks a lot about on her podcast of, you know, who are we outside of the heteronormative dichotomy, right? Like, who are we outside of performative heteronormativity? And I just think it's so funny that Michael is so stiff and made up in this movie, because he's like the drag version of himself in this movie. Although Blaine and I have talked about that it's still better than Resurrection Mask before.
You know, I keep that forgetting mask, Resurrection exists.
It's probably for the best, right?
Right.
We don't talk about
it. But what about that mask?
That mask looks like it was just, I don't know. It looks like Walgreens came up with Crazy Man Mask, and it was meant to look like Michael Myers mask, but it's definitely like the 99-cent version. It's rough. It's, and that hair. Ooh.
It's like all those like knockoff brand name posts that float around Halloween time for costumes, where instead of Beetlejuice, it's like bug something or whatever. Like, that just kills me every time. And like, instead of the nun, it's like spooky priest or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot.
My favorite part of going into any spirit is looking up the names.
Listen, yes. I'm still not forgiving them for tweeting out on April Fool's Day that they were going to have a couple of stores open year round. And for like 2 seconds, I forgot what day it was. And I was like, all right, we're fighting.
Yes. That was an actual disappointment in my life.
I know. Oh, my God.
Like, I wrote about it in my diary.
It was worthy. It was worthy of a note.
Yeah. So, speaking of the other Halloween movies, I would love to hear where this falls on everyone's rankings, because I have very strong opinions about this franchise. Blaine, why don't you start us off?
Oh, gosh. So, I don't know that I can sit here and rank all of them, but I will say that H2O is top three easily. So if I have to do my top three, I'm going with, I don't know, this might be number one. I'm going to go H2O, the OG, and five. I love five. So good.
That is so spicy. I love it.
Yes.
Fafna, what about you?
Oh, goodness. Where this one ranks?
Yeah.
I'd say it's in my top five. I mean, there's enough of them for there to be a top five.
Right?
There's like my favorite will always be the OG, just because it is the OG, and like nothing got me more than the OG, and everything else seemed like a, you know, whatever. Definitely a lot higher than three.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're going to get some spicy comments for that one. That's okay.
Yeah. I had to watch that twice last year, and that's it. That's my quota for, like, this decade. Hit me up next decade to watch it again. But, no, I definitely say it's, like, maybe my – I'd say it's either number four or number five for me, because I do like the first – I do like Halloween 2018. That's the first Danny McBride one, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm not saying the other producer's name. We've given him too much airtime on this spot. His name, too much airtime on this spot. Wow. Please leave that in a 5-star review if you have an issue with what I just said. but no, that one's up there. Like, okay. I'm going to say four. I'm going to say it's my fourth favorite of all the
films. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I think, yeah, this is either number two or number three for me. I mean, the original's number one. 2018 and number two are tied for second place. And then this one, because I love that we skip over the mess that was like four through six or seven at that point. Yeah. And then I love that 2018 picks it, or sorry, 2021 picked it right back up in Halloween Kills, that she has a daughter. I would much prefer her. I mean, okay, so here's where we're gonna get a little into my psychoanalysis notes, if that's okay with everybody. So
absolutely.
I prefer the storyline with the son more than the daughter. And that's not to speak on my mommy issues. It's just in general. But here's the overarching thing about the Halloween franchise. You know, it may not originally have intended to become a cinematic shorthand for PTSD and like your past hunting you down, but that's what it is now. I mean, if anything, 2018 kind of cemented that for us. And so I felt like it was starting with this installment specifically. So the fact that Michael has morphed into kind of a superhuman, incapable of being brought down by anyone except Laurie, I mean, that can be taken at face value, yes, as like a plot hole, right? I know a lot of film bros that are like, oh, it's just a plot hole. But if I'm going to go there with this franchise, I think it's a really good deep dive on how we can have the most amazing team surrounding us, and we can have the most supportive friends and family, but we can still be destroyed by the grief that we carry around. I mean, she literally cannot have sex with her long-term boyfriend because she keeps picturing getting hunted down by Michael Myers. And I really just can't think of anything more relatable than having the shitty, awful series of things that happen to you, especially coming from your family, stalk you, you know?
Yeah, and that really speaks to not being able to run from your issues and having to really reconcile with them being part of you and moving forward with that knowledge as opposed to pretending it doesn't exist, because we see throughout the movie that it truly is like killing her. I mean, she is a functioning alcoholic, as her son says. Her relationship with her son is fractured because he, you know, says that he has to take care of her. And so it's created this relationship and this lifestyle that isn't tenable. And, you know, if we can go back to the awful costume choice, I mean, that also fits in with just trying to be someone that you're absolutely not fit to be. And so I think it is, you know, Jamie, this is a perfect point to be made that Laurie throughout the film series is the PTSD queen or the trauma queen, shall we say.
She is.
And it's something to be celebrated, honestly.
It is. And I think the thing that makes it even more, just makes it a more complete picture and a more, it gives it a little more context as well. And also the reason why it will always have a special place in my heart, is that this was around the time Jamie Lee Curtis chose to go into recovery.
Yeah.
This exact time, like it was either before the film or during filming, either way. I don't remember what the story is, but this right then, like in 97, 98, is when she started her road to recovery, and she's been sober since. And I think that, like, aside from that being a plot point, I think that like feeds heavily into that whole PTSD fact, like her being able to, you know, play it up more and channel that and everything. Like, it just makes it more of a movie than just another Halloween movie to me. That makes it more of a personal movie, and hence why I love it so much, despite the Hot Topic mask.
Listen, and I think this is, for me, and I'm with Blaine on this one, and Bob and I talk about this a lot, I'm always going to love a 90s slasher, right? Like, the vibe is the vibe. I know what I'm here for. I'm well aware. But for me especially, you know, having a loved one who is an alcoholic who I had to help get treatment for, Bob and I are no stranger. We tell people all the time, we love alcohol on a social level. Like, she and I are, she's tipping her drink to me right now. We love a good craft cocktail. But if it is getting to the point in your life that it's destroying your relationships, A, I have to be careful how I respond to people who are addicts because of my own personal experience with that. And I'm like, all right, get your shit together. But B, you know, I think this movie does such a good job of showing what it's really like to try to self-medicate. And I can't think of a movie before this that didn't demonize self-medication, because, like, obviously Bob and I's first episode ever was on the granddaddy of them all with self-medication, The Shining. And I think we're referencing it, what, once every other episode at this point? Because in Urban Legend, we talked about the elevator scene. But it's just so funny to me that, like, women especially are marketed this like wine lifestyle. And then we're also demonized if we have more than, like, you know, what's the line from Arrested Development? She's like, oh, no, it's from Gilmore Girls. Only a whore has two martinis at lunch. And then Richard says that. And then Emily's like, well, paint me up, give me a feather boa and ship me to Reno. Like, we're sold this, like, very glamorous Sex in the City lifestyle to cope with things that are out of our control. And I think especially that's pertinent given the current events at the time of this recording, you guys. So I'm super excited to dive a little bit deeper into this.
Yeah.
Oh, man. You hit the nail on the head with that one.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was just a mouthful. What do you say to that? That's incredible.
I do talk a lot. Yes, I am very I'm very effusive. Correct.
Sorry, I'm still stuck on the Gilmore Girls quote
there. Yeah.
It's my favorite. Listen, it's one of my favorite things Richard says to Emily. Only a whore has, or not a whore. I think he says like only.
Like a floozy. It sounds more like a Richard thing to say.
Mm-hmm. He says only a floozy has more than two martinis at lunch. And she's like, well, give me a feather boa and ship me off to Reno. I just die every time. But I think that that's, you know, I've given us all the giggles. Sorry, guys. I think that that's something this movie hits on really well, where it's like, how many times as women are we gaslit into, it's all in our heads. And I feel like Bobbin and I have talked about this literally every episode at this point. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I could go on this tangent for hours, but I'm significantly more interested in what you guys have to say about all this.
Well, you're right. It's totally a double-edged sword. I think, you know, just thinking from experience, honestly, you're told to have a good time and enjoy yourself and, you know, let loose every once in a while. Gosh, you're so pent up. And then, God forbid, you go for that second glass of wine and some man is going to come over and be like, haven't you had enough? Like, so there's really, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I think beyond alcohol, but just like any mode of enjoyment, if you do it too much, or if you do it more than is deemed adequate by some random white man, it's too much. And you're a whore, or you're A, B, and C, as opposed to just being a human who likes to watch 5 horror movies a day. And that's not a problem, Dad.
Listen, wait, did you read my diary?
I know, airing our business on Maine, Blaine.
But no, you're absolutely right. Like, I definitely have a few, like, I've known a few people, like, I've had a few people in my life that, like, definitely have a functioning problem or have had a functioning problem with alcohol, but it's also that fine line of, like, you know, how much can you help a person in that situation as well? Like, you're having fun, you're whatever, but at what point do you stop being their keeper as well, like, socially? Because I've definitely had a few people, like, who are friends, and it's like, we've gone to parties and stuff, and we all know that one person can't hold it in. So, like, we all end up either drinking a little less, like, our enjoyment gets cut, like, us who can kind of keep it in control, or only have, like, a couple of drinks and we know we're good. I like to call it OLG rules. OLG stands for Ontario Lottery and Gaming Commission. And their logo is Know Your Limit, Play Within It.
That's fantastic.
Wait, I want that on like a tight fitted tank top.
Yes. Yeah, right? No, Know Your Limit, Play Within It. And that's been my rule for like everything.
Yeah.
What I'm taking that with me. Wow. Thank you.
Please do. And buy a scratch ticket. I don't know. But our winnings get taxed up here. But it's like, what do you do at that point as well? It's like, yeah, we get told, you know, it's like, we get told, yeah, your enjoyment, you've had too much to drink, or haven't you had too much to drink? But what do you do now when you have somebody else in that situation? I'm thinking of her son now, you know, he's been, to bring it back to the movie, like he's been kind of held back in his life. And you see that in the film too, like, you know, oh, mom won't let me go to Yosemite. Okay. Mom won't let me do this. It's Halloween. That's the day mom had her trauma. Like, I've been here for her. I haven't had a Halloween.
Yeah.
Which really echoes so much of my own childhood that I was like, this is hitting a little too close to home. It's really interesting to me that they dance around what actually happened. But apparently her son knows parts of it, ? I'm asking you guys because I was like,
yeah.
Huh?
I think he does, because I know at one point he mentions to like his group of friends or something, or like, or no, he talks to his mom and he's just like, you know, Michael isn't around. Michael's gone.
Yeah. It's like you watched him burn or something. And I'm led to believe that, you know, he only knows what she's told him, which is bits and pieces when he's poked and pried and he, you know, has dug around and found things out on his own, and she has no choice but to explain it to him. Typical child things. You know, things that, as a parent, to the point that you were both making, is not his responsibility to worry about and to have to discover on his own or pry out of his mother. So, I mean, just from the moment he was born, I mean, he didn't really have a fair shot at being an autonomous child.
No, he didn't. And he didn't have that chance. It wasn't fair to him either. And this was the era, like I mentioned in the Urban Legend episode, there was no Google. There was no easy way to find out this information. It was ask Jeeves or bust. But no, honestly, like he would have had to have really looked through the news archives at a library or, you know, do some real digging, like called around a couple agencies, maybe called Haddonfield and find out what's going on, blah, blah, blah. But to bring it back to your comparison between that and Halloween 2018 and the whole her having a daughter as well, like I believe this story for Laurie Strode more than I would believe her raising her kid to be militant against Michael.
Like, same.
Come at me, 2018 fans. I'm a 2018 fan as well, but like that was a much more believable Laurie Strode evolution to me, despite the rest of like the movie being camp. But guess what? It's a Halloween movie. If it isn't camp, get the fuck out.
Exactly.
I think we can all agree on that. But at least the Halloween movie's being camp. But I digress. I don't think she would have raised her kid to be a militant, like, I don't know. What's the term for people that prepare for the apocalypse?
Oh, preppers.
Doomsday preppers. Yeah.
Yeah. So a Michael Myers prepper. I don't think she would have raised her kid to be a Michael.
What a show pitch for TLC in an alternate universe where Michael Myers is real. Michael Myers preppers of Haddonfield.
Wait, he isn't real?
Yeah. Well, before we continue, ladies, I think it's high time that we take a quick commercial break.
Yes. Oh, stay tuned for some free thoughts.
And okay, so back. I really need to... Blaine and I... No, go ahead. Blaine and I had a lot of feelings about the score. And this is how we even got on this topic of this movie on Twitter DMs, because we were both flipping out about the score. Go right ahead.
So we have to talk about how the score for this movie is also the score for Scream, as well as, isn't it in Urban Legends or a few of the other movies around that time? Yeah, it is absolutely nuts to me. And I haven't been able, I don't even know how to search for that on Google. Like, why score similar to other scores? Like, so I don't understand if there was like a strike or, you know, I guess a limited amount of horror scoring going on at that time, but it just freaks me out. And it's almost like I just want to stand all of those movies next to each other and like watch how similar the scenes that those, you know, songs are used in. But yeah, it just gets me so worked up. And I'm like, what is going on here? What is the answer? Why? This is now the soundtrack to my dreams.
So it's so funny that you brought this up, because Bob and I had already planned to do the Summer of Slashers, which this is episode 2 of our Summer of Slashers series. And then when you tweeted about it, I was like, okay, we've got to talk about this. Because yes. So Kevin Williamson obviously had very much a heavy hand in Urban Legend, besides writing Scream 1 and 2. And so I understood those thematically lining up. But Scream 2, Urban Legend, and this came out like back to back to back. And they're three of my favorite horror movies. And I just think that speaks so much to the ethos of like what a good tense score can do to us as an audience, on top of yeah. course, being a child of the, you know, 90s and loving the aesthetics.
Listen, it was a great year to be 10.
Right.
And a horror fan. I got everything. But no, like that, a score can definitely bring so much to a movie and take away so much. And I feel like the score definitely helped this movie. Like, had it not had the OST that it did, that, you know, I don't think you could pull off half the scenes in it. without the music. Right. Like, I feel like the music is the invisible character that's just always there, giving a little helping hand, making a scream just a little bit louder in our chairs.
And that's honestly something that could be said about the first movie as well, and does get said about the first movie all the time, is that if you played this on silent, it would not be as tense, which, I mean, I think the first film could work, but this second film, we just don't have any road maps for where it's going to go. And I think that the soundtrack acting as a third character is so interesting, because I honestly think, hot take alert, that's something that modern horror really lacks. We've really leaned into the jump scare philosophy, which, okay, I'm a Paranormal Activity fan, so I have zero say-so in this, but I would love to see a comeback of, like, big, bombastic OSTs. And I think, you know, obviously The Invisible Man played that up a little bit, but I really hope that the next Halloween, which is, like, Halloween Ends.
Yeah,
that's, like, the official name of this next one that's coming out. I really hope that they include some kind of strong soundtrack, because, woof, you guys, 2021. Yeah. There's a reason Boffin and I are, like, putting off covering
it. Yeah. We were so gung-ho about it, too, when it was coming out. We're like, yes, yes, yes. And then we thought, we're like, okay.
Well, and we can talk about this, but do y'all feel like, and this is just me thinking out loud, do y'all feel like the other Halloweens lack the charm that this one has? Because I do. I feel like the first, second, and this one have a very slick charm that the others just do not have.
So the other movies gave me that feeling of, especially when we get into like three, four, and five, you get a lot of the desert dust. It's very windswept. It doesn't have the small town kitschy feel that the first two and H2O does. And that kind of goes back to the kind of 90s feel with the, you know, the chunky knits and the little loafers and all the nice muted colors. And so I totally get what you're saying. And that's why I do appreciate the first two as well as this one the most.
I agree with both of you. And hot take alert here, and I'm pretty sure that people are going to come at me for this one, but I didn't hate the Rob Zombie versions. I actually liked their take, but I don't look at them as a part of the whole. I look at them as like an aside. Just like I look at the Halloween, like 2018 and onwards, as an aside. You know, I look at one and two as an aside. Like, it's very fractured in my brain, the Halloween franchise. And Halloween H2O stands on its own standing glory. Or like as a, like, you know, 2A or 3 as a, you know, part of that whole crew there. But I think this was like one of the last ones to have a more personable charm to it, like that. I am including the Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends trilogy as well. Like, it was the last one to have me actually give a shit about the people in it. Yeah. And like the people part of the plot, like Michael was secondary. I'm like, no, tell me more about this, like, dynamic between you and Josh Hottie over here. Like, tell me more. Give me more Michelle Williams. Give me more, you know,
LL I'm Cool not,
I almost called him Chris. LL Cool J writing erotica.
We haven't even touched on that yet. Okay, so LL Cool J, who is still fine to this day, that man looks incredible. Yes. He is honestly my favorite character besides Laurie in this film. Laurie, Michelle Williams, and LL Cool J are my top three in this movie. LL Cool J was just trying to get it in with his woman. He was writing her erotica. He was going to become an author. And then here comes Laurie Strode fucking up his whole life. And that's something I really, and Bob and I have talked about this off pod so many times. That's something, if we're going to get into like the more real life aspects of this, Lori is such a burden on her friends and family. And I hate that for her, because I know what it's like to be the trauma survivor of the friendship. It's just heavy. We're all like touching our foreheads like, oh my God.
Yeah. Whoops. No, but that's a great point to bring up, is just that, you know, whether she likes it or not, whether she acknowledges what she's been through or not, she's carrying all of this with her, and everyone in her life feels the effects of it. And so it's almost like this whole standoff between her and Michael is a big release. And so I want to, you know, after a few more questions, I definitely want to see your thoughts on the ending. But it really was kind of just, you know, facing off with your oppressor.
It was, but also speaking of LL Cool J being in this, first of all, major points for a man of color writing erotica, regardless of it being published or not. Like, come on. Like, whew.
Ooh. Beautiful.
Also, I think he qualifies as a final boy.
He does.
Between this and Deep Blue Sea.
Wait, no. Can we talk about Deep Blue Sea? I have things to say about Deep Blue Sea. So, this came out.
Correct. Go ahead, Blaine.
Go ahead.
So, H2O came out in 98. And then a year later, Deep Blue Sea came out. So, I fell in love with LL Cool J 1 year and was scared to death that I was going to lose him the next. Can I tell you that Deep Blue Sea was the first movie that made me cry because I thought LL Cool J was dead.
Oh, him no. And his parrot.
Yes. Well, I don't care about the parrot, but it was, you know, it was fine.
Like, so no, this is Deep Blue Sea was the first DVD I ever owned. I mean, it may have come with the DVD player that cost $500 at the time.
Great deal.
But it was the first DVD I ever owned.
I was going to say, that's a great deal to me. I mean, yeah. So while we were rewatching this for like Lord knows the 100th time, Mr. Jamie, my significant other, as I call him, was sitting on the couch next to me. And he was like, wait, is this the one where no, that's Deep Blue Sea. And I said, what? So it's like LL was such a 90s hunk, and like Bob and I are big, big, big fans of pretty much everyone involved in this movie. But yes. I love the thread of 90s TV stars to 90s like movie heartthrobs, because I think Sarah Michelle Gellar was really the bridge or one of the first ones. And I think that this movie was truly like kind of almost unproblematic in its representation, except for there was a little bit of, you know, exaggeration with Elle's girlfriend on the phone, but and the slang that she used. But I think overall, this was one of the most unproblematic 90s movies I can think of.
Yeah, for 90s Agreed. Movies, this Agreed. Does a great job.
Yes. It does.
I mean, there's no homophobia to my knowledge. There's not any gay characters, so that kind of helps, or at least to our knowledge. But there's no, like, bullying of someone and calling them a slur. There's no overt racism, like LL Cool J's there to do his job. And I think, too, and how many of us didn't dream, if we were born in the 90s, of going to boarding school if we didn't go to boarding school.
Right.
We all did.
I mean,
I blame the parent trap for some reason.
Correct. I swear to God, I was about to say the same thing. The parent trap and those books that were like The Click. I don't know if you guys read those too. Yeah, super romanticizing it. But I think, you know, kind of off of our subjective enjoyment of this movie, I think objectively, A, this movie has beautiful aesthetics, but B, I agree with Bhavna. We talk a lot about pacing and how the perfect movie is usually 90 to 95 minutes, maybe 100 if I'm being generous, but I actually think this could be a little longer.
Yeah, it definitely could be a little bit longer. Like, I could have done with 10 more minutes of backstory, because I felt like this movie was very backstory heavy, but not enough, if you know what I mean. Like, I would have paced out the action. I would have made it about 10 minutes longer for the action to be less like, stab, 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 Michael at the side of the road. Because, like, I remember watching this going like, I'm looking at my watch that I don't wear. I'm like, When is there going to be a kill? Has there been a kill yet? Oh no, Michael just stole a car. Okay, cool, cool, cool. He's coming. Oh look, the car about 10, 15 minutes later. All right, finally, it's finally pulling into the town. Okay, well, I don't care about this trip to Yosemite, bro. Where's Michael? Like, also, we're talking about being afraid of him.
Why is the car that Michael steals from like the 1900s? I don't understand.
If I was thought anyone he was, driving
I thought he was going to steal the sedan.
Yeah. The only thing I can think of. Okay, so aside. Yeah, as an aside, like people that follow me know that I'm an avid hiker, and like I went to Yosemite two summers ago now. And they have the iconic like yellow trolleys that take you up if you're going to do a tour, like through the actual gap in the mountains. And they look vaguely like the car that's in the scene that he steals. But what the fuck? Why is he stealing like a jalopy? I don't understand.
That's it. And I thought that after he stole the woman's bag in the public toilets, I thought she was going to steal her keys and take off with her sedan. So literally my surprise, like when I saw him taking off in the fucking, you know, Bonnie and Clyde's car, like
that's what it is.
The Sevens Gang. For all of our John Mulaney fans out there.
Bring it back to pew, 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 pew.
Yeah. But also the little girl in this scene, in the bathroom scene.
Stop.
First of all, I'm not really sure what was supposed to be going on in that scene other than like Michael was busting in to steal her bag. But the little girl in this scene is trying so hard not to laugh, and it's precious.
She was able to sell that like not laughter as being scared, I feel, but like you still saw that little crack.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I'm going to agree. And Blaine, stop us if you have other thoughts. But for me, all of a sudden, Jamie Lee Curtis just goes berserker, steals a coroner's van, shoots out the tires of another car. I'm laughing because it's just so absurd. Like, I can't even get through my checklist of shit that she does in the last 10 minutes of the movie.
Well, let's just take a second to talk about like our last, you know, traumatic PTSD episode and how not like Jamie's reaction it was. Like, I'm sorry. I just want to lay on my kitchen floor and cry for a few hours. This bitch is robbing, you know, a coroner's van and just chopping heads off. Oh, which brings us to that discussion that we should probably have.
Yes. Okay, you guys go first, because I have a lot of feelings about this ending.
Go ahead, Poffman.
I don't even know where to begin. I have a lot of feelings as well, because I felt like, of the Halloween endings, this was probably the most rushed.
Yes.
To me, as much as I do love this movie, I felt like they really just like, Michael's here. Ah, we're in the house. Ah, we accidentally shot someone. And oh no, now we're stealing a car and we're stealing the coroner's van. And, you know, we're taking off, blah, 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 blah. And then I remember the first time I saw this movie and my thought was, that's it. Like, that's it. Yeah. Like, she just took a pickaxe. And the mask went flying and we don't see a body and that's it.
And is that supposed to be the end of the franchise? Like,
well, then we get Resurrection, which
nobody asked for.
Was that her 12th step?
Was that her 12th step? Bhavna, please. Nobody asked for Resurrection. And I also, yeah. I remember seeing this for the first time and being like, oh, surely they're not going to make more. It's been like 2 years after I saw this, Rob Zombie came out with his versions. Okay. This movie is great until it's not. And then the last 3 minutes are such a mess. And I'm totally fine, right? Like Dwayne said, I'm loving this storyline where she gets to confront her oppressor, because you best believe if I could chop the head off, this is going to offend some people. Watch me not care. If I could chop the head off of like some metaphorical situations that led me to be, you know, in therapy today, I absolutely would. Maybe even pull a little, you know, Marie Antoinette guillotine action on some actual people. But I truly just find it so inspiring that we take this, because this is like peak post Lilith Fair feminism, right? Like, shout out Alanis Morissette. We love Alanis Morissette in this house. Truly, like, third wave feminism was happening, cresting at this point, turning into fourth wave. And I just find it so interesting that we have a woman who gets to literally kill the man that traumatized her. But then people were like, what an overreaction, because it's her brother. And I'm just like, okay, and?
I'm sorry. I mean, your brother took your favorite, like, sweater or whatever. This brother just killed a buttload of people and keeps trying to kill me. So I don't want to be anywhere near that. Thanks. Chopping heads.
Yeah, for, like, gay hoofies.
Honestly, like, my brother is not your brother. Like, you know that meme where it's like, this, my whatever is not your whatever. My brother is not your brother. So just deal exactly. with it. But on the topic of brothers, though, or family members, I should say, as an aside, I loved that Janet Leigh was in this, yes. especially given the time of life that it was in Jamie Lee's life as well. Like, one, they got to work together again. Mm-hmm. Two, she got to be that, like, I didn't mind that she was the cheesiest character of the bunch, because, I mean, you're going to get Janet Leigh, a horror legend, like, listen. Despite her familial ties to Jamie, like, to be in this,
right? Like, and I don't care, like, that it was maybe just, you know, a cheap shot to, like, reference Psycho. I fucking loved that. Like, I will take that anytime. And just, like, the way the score changed a little bit to the Psycho score, like, I thought that was beautiful and fitting. And it was like, and Janet Leigh just looks incredible.
She did. I was like, wait a minute. I thought she was, like, a lot older at that point. I'm like, Janet, you're looking good.
Well, I mean, on top of, that's a whole other conversation that women are not allowed to age, but she genuinely looks incredible. And I think it's because she did take a little break, you know, there to have kids from acting. Can you imagine, though, your mom being Janet Leigh?
Right.
All that pressure.
We all just, like, sat in silence for a second. First of all, I'm well aware that Hitchcock was not that great to actors. And as an actor myself, I often rail against this kind of treatment. But I joke all the time that, like, if I could reanimate someone and, like, work with them, he's, like, in my top two. And I think it's really fascinating to me that what kind of roles we allow older women to play in film. Mm-hmm. And it's great now because we have things... You know, first of all, we have Meryl Streep's entire career, right? And we have Glenn Close's entire career. I mean, Helen Mirren, Judi Dench, that kind of thing. But it's fascinating to me of what was available to women of her age in 1996 to 1998, you know? And I just cannot imagine that being my mom and being like coming to set and like Michelle Williams being there and Josh Hartnett. And just being like, these whippersnappers.
Yeah.
Though you meant, like, just not to bring it back to Josh Hartnett again, but always. Underrated Scream King.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Like, have you seen Penny Dreadful?
Have you seen the Faculty?
Excuse me. I could do a TED Talk on the Faculty. I watch it every year without fail.
We are eventually.
I can't stand nasty teen boys, but that nasty teen boy is delicious. I'm not going to say that. Cut it.
No, we're keeping that in.
We agree. So, because you know who else is in the Faculty?
Everybody?
Well, everybody.
Which one? Elijah Wood, Usher,
Clea DuVall.
Clea DuVall, Famke Janssen.
All of them. We have a big 1998 to 2000 problem. Yes, Bebe Neuwirth, correct.
Was that the one that we were going for?
Sure, all of them. As an ATLian, I'm always going to shout out Usher. But we have a big 1997 to 2002 problem on this podcast. And I just think
it's not a problem, Jamie. It's an appreciation. Right.
Listen, hot take. Those were the golden days of slashers. And whenever that decides to get, you know, popping again. I'm here for it. Casting directors, you can find me at. I truly miss the, there's this weird safety, right, that we find in slashers, and especially 90s slashers. And it's formulaic, but it's just the right amount of on the edge of our seat. And I think that's why we keep coming back to these kind of movies. A, for the comfort, but B, I think every time I find something new to talk about with Bhavna and with my guests, and I love that you're on this episode, Blaine, because you and I have talked about, you know, how do you move forward after trauma that doesn't destroy the life of everyone around you? Because I think it would be really easy, right, for trauma survivors to sink down into this, this happened to me and now I get to be shitty, you know, thing. But those of us who are truly working on ourselves are in therapy and are constantly, you know, taking care of ourselves in the ways that we can, because PSA guys, you cannot self-care your way out of the current system that we live under, but it does help in minor, you know, doses. I think that this movie is such a testament to, again, what I said at the beginning, you can have a whole team around you of people that love you, but until you decide to accept their help and kind of accept your fate, quote unquote, air quotes around that, nothing's going to change, right? Like, nothing changes until something changes is that often phrase repeated in recovery. And I just have a lot of feelings about that as it pertains to this movie.
Woof.
I'm sorry, not to bring the room.
No. No, no. Honestly, that's, I love that take just because it just, I don't know how to elaborate on that is my problem. Because you just, you said it so well. It's like, sometimes I think, are we putting too much on a film in terms of the interpretation we're taking out of it? Like exactly what your point just was, our points on alcoholism, our points on like anything we basically discussed except for, you know, the smoke show that is Josh Hartnett.
Always.
Still a smoke show. Still a babe. But it's like, how much of it are we projecting onto it? How much of it is actually intended? Like, that's always been my... that's part of the interest of why I even wanted to do this pod, was to figure out like how much of it was me being like, okay, this is what I'm leeching out of the media that you're giving to me. And, but how much of this did you actually put in on purpose?
And I think that that's something we could go kind of at length about, is how much we're reading into this versus how much was on purpose. Because unfortunately, some of the people that made this film are, you know, no longer with us. And the people that are with us aren't super accessible. And so I'm always really interested in, again, everyone else's take. And that's why we have this pod, because I say all that to say, I think as who I am, it's very easy for me to find those interpretations in these films, especially slasher films with final girls, final women, because we could have a whole conversation about how women are called girls until we're in our like 60s or 70s.
I mean, final quote unquote girls haven't been girls since, I don't know, like 1998. Like, no, even these guys were like, what, senior year? But, yeah, you know, ever since then, they've been more along the lines of women, or, you know, women at least in their mid 20s,
if not older. Yeah.
But to your point, Jamie, I think, you know, it does, it's impossible not to read your own experiences into movies or any media you consume. So I don't think it's fair to us to, you know, ask too much. Am I reading, am I taking too much from this movie? Am I seeing what I want to see as opposed to what the makers intended? I mean, obviously that is a great question to ask a lot of the time, but I try really hard to, you know, take it easy on myself in that, you know, you can still be considered like a critic, or you can still, your point of view on this is still valuable, regardless of what the intentions were. I mean, a lot of creators, when they hear what their work meant to other people, they didn't realize that that's what they were doing. They were just putting something out into the world. And typically what I've heard on a lot of interpretations, you know, the somewhat good stuff or the heartwarming stuff, it makes creators feel good that, you know, their work spans languages, spans experiences, spans, you know, countries and, you know, what have you. I think viewing movies in that sense is so beautiful. And it makes me happy that while it is such a turbulent, traumatizing genre, horror allows us to see those things that we can't really see anywhere else.
Agreed. And to your point, Blaine, as well about creators and stuff, I heard somewhere or I read somewhere about Stephen King. I think I heard it. About how, you know, people will approach him and it's almost like a dime a dozen to him, not to him as in like, more like an occurrence, not the, how it registers with him, but the most common thing he'll get is how much his work means to whoever's saying it. Like, that's the most common thing he'll get is like, your work meant so much to me. It helped me do XYZ in my life, or it helped me through ABC moment, or, you know, all this kind of stuff, or like, you know, you really got me through my childhood or things like that. And like, I know it does sound crass to kind of belittle or not belittle, like it kind of sounds belittling to kind of boil down someone's like life like that and stuff like that. And it must be so overwhelming for him to hear, but like, he always takes that in stride, again, from what I've heard. But it's like, but I've also heard that he doesn't put in half of those interpretations into his work. Like, he'll just be like, especially some of his older works, he's just like, I was just high on cocaine, man.
Listen,
I was just drunk as fuck.
He was that gift of Kermit, like banging it out on the typewriter.
Basically, but it's like, but it is nice to like, but from what I've, to long story short, what it is like, you know, he does get a new perspective from stuff like that. So I also think like, it's not just we're taking things out of the media that we're consuming. We're also giving back to the creator in some way, shape or form.
100%. Well, Blaine, I would love for you to start with your closing final thoughts before we wrap it up here.
Oh gosh, here's all I can say is long live LL Cool J, and thank goodness the 90s happened and gave us this movie, regardless of how it fits in the franchise or its, you know, content. It's perfect in every way. Chef's kiss.
Amen. Bobna?
Same, like 1998, What a Time to Be Alive, Urban Legend, Scream 2, Halloween H2O, which, fun fact, I always forget, came out in 1998 only because the H2O made me think millennium. But yeah. But I mean, what a great year for horror fans and horror slasher fans. You had a bit of the new, you had a bit of the old, and you, would we have a bit of the ugly? I don't think so. I don't think there was a single ugly person in all three of those movies we just mentioned. I don't think so. But no, like, my closing thoughts, just, I mean, it was of its era. It's something I would bury in a time capsule for 98. It will always hold a place in my heart for being fun as heck, regardless of everything. Like, even if I looked at it as a one-off, you know, like as its own little entity, perfect. Wouldn't change anything, regardless of my notes on this and the pacing and all that stuff. Amazing. Perfect movie to put on in the back at a party and everybody knows, or to spark conversation to be like, is that Michelle Williams? Also, side note on that, just to bring it back to our Urban Legend episode again, the people of Dawson's Creek had a monster year that year outside of their television show. You had Pacey, you had Joshua Jackson on Urban Legend, and then you had Michelle Williams on here. Like, excuse me, like, was Katie Holmes sleeping?
Oh, no, she was in another one. It was called Disturbing Behavior or something like that.
Yep. Oh, was that?
She had her own little stint. Yeah.
Well, then, I mean, it was pre-Tom Cruise, so shrug. But closing thoughts. Honestly, add this to your summer slasher list. Add this to your Halloween month rewatch. Add this to your Halloween franchise revisit, because it's worth taking a look at again. I mean, for a bunch of reasons, but I'm just personally going to say, for the smoke show, that is Josh Hartnett.
He does have the perfect 90s, like, spiky bangs going on.
Yes. And his triangle hair is coming back.
It is. Oh, God, why? So closing thoughts. This is always going to be in my top 3 to 5 of the Halloween franchise, given the subject matter and given the styling and the storyline in general. I think it's genius that, you know, Laurie Strode would run away and become a literal new person and change her name and choose to educate the youth of America, question mark. I did want to see more about how she got her, you know, degrees that would allow her to become a headmaster of a very posh private school. As she says, a very posh, protected private school in the hills of California, verbatim a line from the movie. I think this is a perfect time capsule of 1998. If my significant other is listening, I would love for you to do a Halloween date for me like Josh Hartnett does for Michelle Williams, sans, you know, getting stabbed and everything, and chased by the homicidal killer. But I just think it's such a comfort film for me for so many reasons. And I really want the return of a wholesome slasher, which sounds like an oxymoron, but I miss that. I miss that vibe a lot. Well, Blaine, before we close out, where can we find you and Ladies in Ligaments on social media and how can we support you?
Oh my goodness. Well, so you can listen, rate, subscribe to Ladies in Ligaments wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to follow on Twitter, it is at Ladies Ligaments. And that is no and, it's just Ladies Ligaments. And then I can be found on Twitter as well at SomeHagInBlack. And I'm on there all the time. So I'd love to chat with you.
And Blaine has a phenomenal podcast, like we said, in Ladies in Ligaments. Very fun listen. We're super excited for the continuing of the next season. Well, guys, you can find us as at Bloody Broads Pod on all social media. You can like, subscribe, rate, and review on basically any platform. Please leave us a review. It helps us so much. And if you didn't like this episode, leave it in a 5-star review and tell us why. Otherwise, until next time, guys, bye.
Bye.